Chapter 12. London, April 1929. Tom has returned to London for the Easter holidays, and he has found himself a studio, the boathouse in Putney that has belonged to his family since he was a boy. They used to keep a dinghy in it for outings on the Thames, but the place was abandoned after Tom's father came back from the front, when it became clear that he was no longer the sort of man who went on boating trips. The boathouse should have been sold along with the dinghy, but Tom's mother cannot quite bring herself to believe that there will never be another trip on the river. To sell it would be irrevocable confirmation of that. So it has remained virtually untouched for over a decade. It is a large space, made hazardous by old sailing paraphernalia. There is a roll of ancient sailcloth in one corner, and a precarious stack of life jackets on a high shelf to the back. A couple of mildewed oars lean tiredly against the wall, and tangled heaps of ropes, toggles, and pieces of old material litter the floor. It is perfectly serviceable, though, and as Tom isn't the tidiest person when he's working anyway, it suits him. Everything has a slightly paint-splattered effect now, which is rather cheering. It looks a less desolate place than before. There is more light than one might expect from a large, shell-shaped window above the tall double doors. Mrs. Stafford thinks that Tom is using the space to revise for the end-of-year exams, and he hasn't said anything to disabuse her of this. The pieces that he has worked on over the last couple of weeks are stacked facing the walls. Tom finds that to have his work visible while he is painting is intolerable. Either it depresses him, he has his days when it seems that everything he has produced is completely execrable, or it intimidates him, if, say, there are a couple of works on display in which he feels, by some fluke, he has reached a peak that he may never attain again. It is better not to have to look at them. Sometimes he flings open the door so that he can gaze at the stretch of water visible through them and attempt to capture the scene. His presence is a source of some curiosity for the other boathouse users. Several rowing teams train on the river, and they treat him with a slightly bullying camaraderie. The third building down from his is owned by a rather glamorous Italian family, who always come down with their own skipper, fully attired in nautical whites and blues. Before Alice came back into his life, he had thought himself rather in love with the eldest daughter, with her slow dark eyes and fall of thick black hair. Alice is coming to the studio this afternoon. Lord and Lady Hexford are out of the country on political business of her stepfather's, and Alice has seized the opportunity for an excursion that she knows would otherwise be illicit. Lady Hexford isn't one to forbid, exactly, but she has her delicate ways, the power to make things difficult for her daughter if she goes against her wishes. For Tom, the occasion could not be more momentous. He is going to show his work to another person, and it will mean the exposure of his innermost self. Alice is the only person close to him that he can trust to deliver the truth. His mother, in her love for him, would be unable to be objective. He knows that anything would be, to her, a work of genius. His Oxford friends, unthinkable. Alice will be candid, but she won't ridicule him, at least. It is a leaden day for spring, with rain coming in sideways, so the doors are shut, and Tom has had to light all the lamps because it is as dark as twilight outside. These preparations will keep him dry, but they also mean that he won't see Alice coming, won't have time to prepare himself. He bought a cheap bottle of wine on the way here for them to share when she arrives, though he has already drunk a large glass to steady his nerves. Shortly after 3 p.m, there is a bang on the door.
"Open up! It's a monsoon out here!"
He takes a swift gulp of wine and swings the doors wide. A bedraggled figure stands before him, water cascading from the brim of a heavy-duty sou'wester, a bicycle propped against one hip. Tom stares. The figure laughs, lays the bicycle down and rushes at him, enveloping him in a sodden embrace. Once inside, Alice pushes back her hood. Her nose is red and her eyes are wet from exhilaration and the unseasonably bitter wind. The fine fronds of her damp hair are black as licorice and wild above the turned-up lapels of the coat. He ushers her in. Would she like to take off the coat, or perhaps keep it on until she's warmed up? Would she like a glass of wine?
A biscuit. She laughs. I'm fine. Stop fussing. It's nice and warm here. She peers about her.
Where did you get the bicycle?
It belongs to William, one of our footmen. He hardly ever uses it, only when he makes the trip to his mother in Hackney. Thank goodness Mara's away with the evil stepfather. I think it's safe to assume she won't approve of me cycling round London, wearing a cricket sweater and men's breeches. Alice shrugs off the coat to reveal the outfit. She looks like a beautiful boy. She moves about the room, studying the paraphernalia.
Do you enjoy having all of this about you?
He grins.
When it isn't trying to kill me, yes, I suppose I do. But it's more that it doesn't have anywhere else to go.
Then she spots the canvases.
Why are they all turned that way round? I can't see any of them.
I prefer them like that. I'm not used to showing my work to people. You're the first, actually. I'm worried it might be a bit, well, pointless. You making this trip, especially.
What do you mean?
It might not be any good. I don't want to waste your time.
She stares at him.
What utter nonsense. Tom, I asked to see them. You didn't drag me here. I think the least you can do, now I've nearly drowned myself getting here, is to satisfy my rude curiosity.
All right. Where to begin?
Can he show her the most recent work, the one he is most proud of? It is the oil of the redhead. And while he has reworked the eyes meticulously, he can't be certain that Alice won't glimpse her own eyes behind them, through the layers of paint. Tom studies the blank backs of the canvases in their ugly wooden frames. He knows each without having to turn them. Finally, he decides. It is a small charcoal of Rosa, his second favourite. The essence of his sister is there, even if the chin isn't quite right. But the shape of the brow and nose is nearly perfect, and the expression, too, is Rosa's. It is her older sister look, appraising, amused. Alice turns, notices him clasping the small frame.
Can I?
He hands it to her. She studies it, and he watches her. There is a tiny mole, a freckle, really, on the back of her left hand, near the base of her little finger. He stares. How can something so trifling hold such charm? It seems an eternity before she speaks, though it is only a matter of moments. Then, simply, it's wonderful. He looks up at her in surprise.
I mean it. This is Rosa, the Rosa I remember.
She laughs.
Well, not exactly. She was 14 when I last saw her. But she has the same expression precisely. I remember it so clearly.
Thank you.
Even in his vainer moments, he had not anticipated this. He feels hope bloom. By the end of the afternoon, all the pieces have been turned around, even those Tom vowed he would never show to another soul. The room is ablaze with colour now, in defiance of the miserable weather without. Alice has studied each work in turn, minutely. When she reaches his study of Wynard Cove, constructed from memory still vivid through the telescope of the years, she turns to him and her eyes are wet with tears.
Tom, she says fiercely, this is what you must do. I'm certain of it. I know I haven't any expertise whatsoever, but you don't have to have it to be moved by something, to understand, to feel how good it is, how unique,
Alice thinks.
You should meet my Aunt Margaret. She isn't an artist, but she is an expert of sorts.
She is speaking rapidly, excited, and she reels off a series of names, artists whom her aunt has apparently advised, a list that includes several of Tom's personal heroes. He sits forward in his seat, tense with excitement.
I'd love to meet her.
Alice nods.
You'd like her? She's Pa's sister. She's similar to him in many ways. Pa was famous for his bravery, but Aunt Em has been just as adventurous, just as courageous in her own way. She was a suffragist in her youth, you know. She walks with a cane now, and it's because of that. They caught her scaling the fence at Westminster. One of the policemen hit her knuckles and she fell and crashed her hip. My grandparents were mortified by the disgrace. They were terribly traditional. Funny that their children turned out the way they did.
She sounds fascinating.
She is. Her marriage caused a fuss, too. Her husband was years older than her, an Italian and Jewish, which did not go down well with my grandparents. He was also enormously rich, though money's never been important to Aunt Em, or rather only in so much as it allows her independence. Ma has always been fond of making remarks of the "he was the only one who would have her" sort. But I know it's not true. She could have taken her pick. Aunt Em might not be beautiful like Ma, but she's got such energy. She makes me... I can't explain it exactly. She makes me want to be something more than what is expected of me.
Tom nods, understanding.
Lady Margaret's London residence is a Bloomsbury apartment, an exquisite arrangement of rooms and a pair of large French windows leading out onto a delicate roof garden with a view to the buildings on the other side of the square. Tom is surprised that someone of her prodigious wealth lives in a space of such modest size, even if it is a smart address. The apartment is not much larger than the ground floor of his parents' house. Alice explains that this is one of many of her aunt's homes, in the city in which she spends the least time. Three of the others are abroad, in Rome, in Venice, and Marrakesh. The red brick exterior of the building is identical to all of the others in the square. Once inside, Tom finds it easy to forget that he is in England at all. If one chose not to look through those glass doors onto a scene so unmistakably British, it could not be anywhere else. One could imagine that this was a Moroccan Riyadh. The air, even, seems different to the air outside, where the smell of wet pavements pervades. He can smell fig, amber, and the weighty, exotic scent of frankincense. Tom first meets Margaret's likeness in an early cubist nude that hangs on the opposite wall as they come in. It is done in the naïve style, with a fecund circle for a belly and further smaller circles to represent the breasts. For all the crudity of the shapes and simplicity of the colour palette, it is replete with the personality of the sitter. The style is at once reverential and playful. The woman's gaze challenges her onlooker, but the smiling feline mouth implies amusement. What talent the artist must have, Tom thinks, to convey all of this. How brilliantly he has distilled the essence of the subject into the work. There are works of art everywhere, from every modern school he knows of, and many that are unknown to him, shocking in their newness and flouting of convention. The very doorknobs here are made from porcelain, painted in an earthy pattern of primary colours that seems to him distinctly Bloomsburyan. And there is a gorgeous oil of seated women, the colours almost pungent in their vividness, in the style of Gauguin, perhaps Gauguin himself. Anything seems possible here. His sketchbook is heavy beneath his arm. Why on earth did he allow himself to be persuaded to bring it? He knows the answer. He was swept up in Alice's enthusiasm, intoxicated by it even, and through her he saw himself as a real artist, worthy of Lady Margaret's attention. Next to these brave, brilliant works, however, his own attempts seem jejune, humiliating in both their hesitance and their pretension. He is thrown out of his funk by the arrival of Lady Margaret into her sitting room. Alice's aunt is, in a word, astonishing. She wears loose pantaloons in a vivid green silk, far more shocking than the most revealing flapper's skirt. These are topped by what appears to be a man's dress shirt, several sizes too large for her thin frame, and tucked in so that it billows extravagantly at the waist. A jewel of the same hue as the trousers flashes at her collarbone. Her limp is prominent, though she carries it well, and she walks with a silver-topped cane of polished ebony. Her hair is wet, smoothed back over the crown of her head, and Tom can see that it is short and very red.
"Alice, my darling."
Her voice, as low as his own, has a gentle roughness to it that speaks of cigarettes and a life well lived. She enfolds Alice in her arms. Then her heavy-lidded gaze moves in his direction, and Tom, too, is clasped in her fragrant and rather bony embrace.
You must be Tom.
She takes a step back, but keeps a hold of his upper arms so that she can look at him.
Delighted, she murmurs,
and he echoes the word to her rather stupidly. She draws away and surveys them both.
Have you been waiting for me a terribly long time?
No, begins Tom, but Alice says playfully,
Yes, Aunt. Tom's practically grown a beard since we arrived. Luckily, you have all this art about, so we had something to entertain us.
I am a scoundrel, Lady Margaret says confessionally. I told you so specifically 4 o'clock, but I've developed a fondness for long baths, especially in the afternoon. Once you're in, it's like entering a different world. One tends to lose any sense of time. It rejuvenates one splendidly for the evening, particularly important for we elderly.
Tom cannot imagine anyone less befitting the label elderly, and laughs despite himself. Lady Margaret turns to smile at him. Then her gaze falls to the sketchbook beneath his arm. He feels his every muscle tense, his hand gripping the spine of the book involuntarily. Margaret's eyes run over him, and she seems to make a quick calculation.
First, I think, tea is in order. One cannot discuss art on an empty stomach.
Tea, mint leaves stewed in the pot, and cake, spiced, almond-studded pastries specially imported from Turkey, are brought in by the enigmatic Beatrice, Margaret's young housekeeper, who smiles at them dreamily, but doesn't say a single word. Margaret explains that this is because she only speaks Italian, and a Venetian dialect at that. She looks, thinks Tom, like a Modigliani model, with large, rather vague grey eyes, in a perfectly oval face and a slender white neck that is bent forward like the stem of a bloom, grown too heavy for its support. Lady Margaret bids Tom pass her his sketchbook. It is as though the strange, delicious tea and the deep purr of her voice have had a soporific effect upon him, for Tom realizes that he no longer feels any anxiety about doing so. He hands the book over. Lady Margaret pores over it in silence, while Tom and Alice make rather strained small talk, Tom keeping half an eye on his sketchbook. He can't help noticing that Margaret spends far longer on certain pages and flicks through some as though there were nothing there. Clearly their contents are considered beneath her notice. It is a humbling experience. After an apparent eternity of time, Lady Margaret's head snaps up.
I think you have some way to go, she says. There is something here, but you need to work at it. Draw it out. Tom nods.
Yes, I need much more experience before I can produce anything.
It is not necessarily a matter of experience, though, Lady Margaret cuts him off. It is a matter of confidence. Tell me, if it isn't art, what is it to be?
You mean, what shall I do? She nods. Well, law, most likely. My father is a lawyer. I know that's what my parents would like to see me doing.
He thinks of boyhood visits to his father's office, the smell of aged paper, the dusty, wasting hours, and feels the familiar panic rise within his chest.
Do you think of yourself as an artist? Or a lawyer? I'd certainly like to consider myself a painter one day.
No! Lady Margaret shakes her head emphatically. That is not the way to go about it. I have always felt that to be an artist of the true sort, and therefore the only sort that matters, you must believe in your vocation absolutely. To hope is not enough. You cannot go about as a boy with a hobby on the side and produce work of the highest caliber.
She points behind her at the cubist nude.
What do you see?
It's a fantastic piece, Tom begins. The artist must be extremely talented.
That is not what I mean, she admonishes. What I find in it is bravery. Courage to go beyond convention, beyond ingrained ideas of style and form. You need practice, yes. You must hone your eye, certainly, but that is not what is holding you back. Technically, excellent though these may be, she gestures to the sketchbook.
There is something almost apologetic about them. To truly create, to innovate, you cannot care about the sensibilities you may offend. You cannot mind that some people, your own mother perhaps, will violently dislike your work. Do you understand?
Tom nods, and Alice gives him a secret smile of encouragement.
What I see here, Lady Margaret taps the open page of the sketchbook with a long finger, is potential, but undeveloped. You are handicapped by a lack of self-belief, and that, she looks up at him, is my diagnosis.